Welcome to another edition of Lex Talk History, a podcast produced in collaboration with WUKY and the Lexington History Museum. Now, here's your hosts, Lexington History Museum Executive Director Mandy Higgins and WUKY's own Alan Lytle.
Lex Talk History, the name of the program. Joining me again is Mandy. Mandy, wow, what a march we've been through here.
What a march. It has been ups and downs, right? Like, the last time we talked, I still had hope for the basketball season. It was going to be great. We've had sunny days and rainy days, but the museum has consistently been awesome.
And that is the best news of all, of
right.
course.
Of know. Course.
So what's been going on at the museum?
Yeah, so we had a great Lex Talks at the start of the month, and we said our sweet goodbyes to Driftwood. It was wonderful to have. And now we're turning our sights towards April. We're starting some really great partnerships with some Fayette County Public Schools as they think about how to do history and how to tell the history of their schools and of the area. We're really excited to have a Center College student as an intern who's working on a traveling trunk. So fifth grade teachers, this is for you. This is for you. We heard from our a couple of people that bringing Kentucky history and Lexington history into a fifth grade classroom was really difficult. And that makes sense, right? Because that's at the time the standards asked for the American Revolution. Kentucky's not actually a state during the American Revolution, though there are European colonists in the area, of course, and Kentuckians fight in the American Revolution. So we decided, and with the help of some partners from Civic Lex and from Keeland Foundation, to create a hands-on trunk that will help teachers bring in local history. There's an activity about coins and coinage. There's a quill activity so students can read a letter written by a Lexingtonian about Lexington in the 1780s and then write their own using a quill, and a little bit about, some of the better known Lexington revolutionaries, revolutionary soldiers and areas. So something like Bryan Station and the women at Bryan Station, as well as the McConnells and their, all the people. So we're very excited to deploy that, to have that out in the world in the next couple of months and definitely by the start of the school year. So as you're thinking about fifth grade teachers, I know you want it to be summer. But before you leave your classrooms and you're thinking about the fall, please reach out. We would love to get this material into your hands.
Anything that helps them with their lesson plannings, I'm sure they're going to be very receptive to that.
That's the hope. That is the hope.
I think it's great, too, because you're making history tactile.
Yes. I have a fifth grader in my life. My oldest child is a fifth grader, and we've been testing some of this on her, and she is into it. Now, I love her. She's a little nerdy.
Is there a butt coming?
She's a little nerdy. Okay. She loves a reading. She's really into Hamilton. So this is right up her alley. We're hoping, and she tells us that her friends would also love it, even her friends who don't like to read. So, again,
wow.
Give us a call. 859-440-1582.
There you go. And when is the museum open?
We are open Thursdays and Fridays, 12 to 4, and Saturdays, 10 to 4. Teachers, you also can bring your students Monday through Friday. Reach out. We'll schedule. Someone is there Monday through Saturday.
All right. Shall we get to the Lex Get Into It part?
Yeah, Lex. Yes. Of course we should.
Let's get into it.
We are so excited. This month, it is April, which in Lexington always means the races, to have our dear friend Rhoda Ferrero back to talk to us about Keeneland.
Hey, Rhoda.
Hello.
Rhoda is, of course, a member of the museum's Board of Trustees and is the director of the Keeneland Library.
Thank you so much for having me.
We're so excited. So this year is the 90th year of racing at Keeneland.
It is.
Can you tell us a little bit about Keeneland's thinking and what's going on?
Yes. Well, October will mark that 90-year point. October 15th was the First day of racing in 1936. At Keeneland, about 8,000 rather, people showed up that day. We have a larger than life, really fun issue of the Lexington Herald that was, it was produced just to cover that opening. So you have all these really rich 2-page spreads on these massive newsprint pages. And I think that if you spend a little bit of time just in that one issue, you know, you get a sense of what local perspectives were like at the time. I mean, you know, we're still in the Great Depression. You also see all of these local businesses and who is taking out ads and how those folks that are taking out the ads are kind of choosing to position their business in this larger moment, you know, kind of in Lexington's time. So super cool. So I encourage folks that if they want to come out and just hang out with that issue, give me a heads up and we'll pull it and we'll have it ready. But yes, we've got Breeders' Cup, really, that's going to be on the heels of the 90th. And Keeneland did a lot of celebrating in 250. So it would have, last year was the 90th anniversary of the founding of the Keeneland Association. So the old Kentucky Association track closes in 1933. We have the first 3-year period, really, since the 1820s in Lexington, where there wasn't a dedicated venue for racing. And that tended to fall in spring and fall always over that long history. But between 1933 and 1936, no racing here in Lexington. So at the closure of the Kentucky Association track, it didn't take long for influential horse owners, local businessmen, politicians to establish a committee that was, its sole mission was to just drive around Lexington, cultivate prospects, maybe find that next spot that could be the future for having that racing venue back in town once financially people were ready to get there. Again, you know, we're in the middle of the 1930s here. So they set their sights on a lot of different farms that were being developed, but eventually they settled on Jack Keene's 147 acres that sat just about 6 miles west of downtown Lexington. I think the real allure of Jack's facility versus some of those other sites that they had considered was that he had almost a completely built plant. So the barns were there. The water supply was there. So that infrastructure was huge. He had a building that could be easily converted to a clubhouse. So really all they needed to do was, and the track was there, and a training track. So all they really needed to do was to erect a grandstand, make some adjustments, beef up that infrastructure a bit in terms of utilities, and there you go. You know, like less than a year later, we have racing. October 15th this year in 1936 will mark that 90-year anniversary.
That's incredible. Mm-hmm. How I actually don't know this. Mm-hmm. How involved was the city in helping? Mm-hmm. You said boost utilities, mm-hmm. those sorts of things. Was there municipal buy-in for this?
There was, although when the association was founded, it's an association of subscribers. So those were private individuals who subscribed to form this association. And we have also at the library, we have the original prospectus from 1935, which is this really neat kind of and concise and really beautifully packaged document that laid out the philosophy of this association, what they were aiming for. There's some pretty cool sketches of the way they envisioned taking that core of Jack Keene's plant and how it might be transformed to a racing facility for the public. And you see some language there that forever set the tone of what would follow. So there's a recurring reference to preserving the past, investing in today, and doing both of those things to inform what comes next. And I think it's that kind of thinking that led to things like a racetrack being a primary funder for a library. Mm-hmm. So just 3 years after that first, you know, that first fall meet, the Keeneland Library opened. And again, I think that was just those founding folks, it was their way to solidify that that was more than just talk, that there needed to be an entity out there that was chronicling and sharing what came before. And I mean, they backed that up when they've supported the library. It's our 87th year or so.
What did they, so it starts 3 years after the races, what kinds of material were the original deposits and the things that they felt like needed to be on site?
Yes. So Arnold Hanger, who was a trustee at Keeneland at the time, he also was, I guess, in many ways, maybe like this Renaissance man, right? Really well-read and just a bibliophile. So he brokered the initial few thousand volumes that became the nucleus of the Keeneland Library. And the library did not, well, actually, for most of its history, I was going to say, it didn't reside for long, but for most of its history, it did not reside in its current building. So the library as we know it today up on the hill is that freestanding stone structure that a lot of people think is a chapel. That opened in 2002. But the library had different iterations over the years, but it spent most of that 87 years in its dedicated facility that was down by the track.
Oh, wow.
Yes, and actually, in the new paddock building that is opening this spring, there is an old library bar is one of the new spaces in the new paddock building that is a nod to where the library was for decades. So it's in that same location.
That's incredible.
It is incredible. And the architects and designers reached out to us for every part of that construction process, from the exterior design to what the interior spaces would look like, because the goal was to have those spaces inside and out look as if they had always been a part of Keeneland. And that's really a neat thing to look back at photographs over time, or just to hear people commenting about what their experience is like walking around Keeneland at different moments of history, you know, where, you know, we have in the record grandparents, you know, talking to their grandkids on a race day in the 80s about this is how Keeneland has always looked. And it was actually just after a major expansion under the Bassett administration, you know. So that was the hope this time. So the team that designed that new space spent a lot of time with us in the library going through blueprints, looking at old photos, looking at how people described the spaces, what they saw, even getting down to taking the patterns that were on upholstery in some of these spaces and modernizing them a bit in color tone maybe. And it just a slight variation on the shape and then just going for it. So when you walk into that old library bar, I see all of those signs, you know, of the old library around me because I know what the old library looked like, from the pattern on, you know, the curtains to the shape of the couches. So
oh, that's incredible. Mm-hmm. So this building, was it freestanding from the paddock that existed?
No.
It was a part of?
No, it basically sat right atop, so South Gate entrance, mm-hmm. by where there's that information center and where you stop in the mornings to start your tours at Keeneland. South Gate, there's a like a balcony that you walk under if you're entering Keeneland at the South Gate. The library was atop that.
Wow.
It occupied that space. So same space that the new old library bar occupies now.
That's incredible. Mm-hmm. I can't imagine like going to do research and a race is coming off or there's, you know, somebody warming up on the track.
That's yes.
Like, yeah.
Well, and the librarians of old used to serve sherry sometimes. I think I kind of draw the line at that today. Like, I feel like we've got enough going on in terms of our service volume. I don't know that I'm going to set up a mini bar on a daily in the library, but maybe it's something we could aspire to.
One day, maybe. If we need, like, a cocktail after a particularly rough research session, just send them to the library bar.
Yes.
It'll be fine.
Yes.
That's incredible. You just sort of, you mentioned this, that somebody coming in the 80s and having the changes. So can you walk us through a little bit of those big changes over these last 90 years and the ways that you know, I didn't know about the library. So what are some of these other pieces that we think of as always being Keeneland that are actually not?
Yes, that, you know, where there's been that somehow striking that balance between maintaining what's there, but pivoting, you know, and evolving to kind of meet today's needs and just capacity needs too. So I think one example of that in terms of a staple, and then just one staple, and then I'll talk about Keeneland more broadly, is the Track Kitchen. So, I mean, the Track Kitchen is a fixture for us and a lot of folks outside the Bluegrass as well. And but the building that it now resides in did not open until the late 70s. But the first Track Kitchen opened in 1939, that same year that the library opened. So what remains the same is that there was always this effort on the backside to serve food, good comfort food, to folks, whether they were working on the backside or they were visiting the track. But it's just evolved. Like they just needed a little bit more space. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of folks would argue that it needs more space again today. So who knows? We'll see what happens next.
You know, some mornings it certainly is difficult to get in there.
Yes. Yeah. But, you know, in terms of the Keeneland more broadly, if you're looking for things that are just kind of iconic Keeneland, you know, we can thank Jack Keene for quarrying the stone on that land to build those original stone structures with that pattern that is so quintessentially Keeneland. And the introduction of some of that Palladian, the windows and the arches, those are things that were there from the beginning and that have been kind of maintained over time. So when they built the first grandstand, for example, and the clubhouse and grandstand were two separate buildings for decades. Mm-hmm. And the paddock sat kind of behind both of them. And there was much more in the way of green space between the buildings and the aprons, and the horse would parade from the paddock to the track, not under a tunnel, but between mm-hmm. those two buildings with all that space. But the whole side of the grandstand has these big arches, you know, and that base of that, the original grandstand sat about 1,500 people, has these arches and that stacked stone. And, you know, it looks so familiar. And little by little, starting in the 60s, there were expansions onto both the clubhouse and the back side of the grandstand. But starting in the 60s, there was a concerted effort to merge the two buildings. And that was wrapped by the 60s. And then in successive construction projects over the years, you just see the grandstand kind of going upward and then enclosing what had been an open porches on the clubhouse to that, like that glassed-in structure that we see today. So that solid expanse of building has really only been at Keeneland since the 60s. So for the first 30 years of its existence, you had these two very distinct spaces. And the photographs are just amazing. So again, feel free to reach out anytime you want to see some of those photos.
And there are a few on display at the museum as well.
Yes.
And it is hard to look at them. Not hard. It's incredible. But you look at them and trying to place yourself of like, no, that's solid. Like, that shouldn't be there. What are we talking about?
Yes.
It looks like, is it the association track? Is this Red Mile? Like, what are we doing?
Yes.
But then you see the stone and you know immediately
and you know.
that
yes.
is Keeneland.
And then another icon, mm-hmm. I think, would be the Sycamore. The Sycamore has been around since Keeneland's inception. It does not predate it. So it is by no means the oldest tree on the grounds. It's not even close. But it is just such an iconic tree. So if you also want to see photos of the baby sycamore, in its infancy, right there in the middle of that paddock. Back then, the saddling enclosures sat right behind the grandstand building, and the whole usage of that paddock was, the orientation was very different. But you still see that sycamore. And a cool thing to me of the paddock and its evolution over time, especially now with the new paddock building. So the sycamore's there, the trees are there. Just the usage of the space and where the horses are being saddled has now changed. But the the new building that opens this meet, mm-hmm. there's one of the new spaces is called the 1936 room. And in this room, the jocks' quarters are now underneath the 1936 room. So the jockeys will come up before every race and walk through the 1936 room on a path of brick pavers right out into the paddock. And those horses will now be stabled on that side, you know, rather than that kind of almost semicircular saddling area that has been there since the 80s. And the beauty of repositioning that is that I love the old saddling, you know, all those saddling enclosures there at the end. I love the arches. I think it's a beautiful statement. But it would always bottleneck on that side of this elongated paddock, you know, close to that. Whereas now you're going to have the entire length of the paddock to be able to see that action and the jockeys coming up and that engagement. And I think it'll just be a good opportunity, you know, for people to engage with that in a way that they couldn't because they wouldn't have been able to get quite so close before.
Yeah, that's so incredible. Mm-hmm. The sycamore, going back to the sycamore, mm-hmm. you know, every meet you see people taking pictures
yes.
with it and there. And I wonder, does the library or does Keeneland have like generations of family pictures or of, you know, jocks or whatever with the sycamore?
We don't have, that's a great idea.
Yeah.
We don't have a concerted, deliberate, mm-hmm. We're cataloging this and every year in terms of like we want to, like, we're going out there and capturing that and bringing it back and cataloging it. We just do happen to have a lot because it is just kind of so, it's that experience everybody kind of wants. And we have photos of proposals, you know, of weddings, mm-hmm. of all sorts of things under the sycamore. But the sycamore, I think, is a good place for me to point out that Alma Headley Hagen, who was the daughter of one of the founders of Keeneland, Hal Price Headley, it was her mission to stand by another statement that was in that initial prospectus that we talked about earlier, that Keeneland would remain, you know, this bucolic setting and would preserve bluegrass land. And I don't think any one person in history has done more than Alma to champion that and then to maintain it and then to ensure that subsequent generations of her family had that same degree of commitment. So, you know, that all the trees that you're seeing in the paddock, the hundreds of varieties of trees that you see across the grounds, the nursery of trees and shrubs that we have on acreage at Keeneland that folks might not even realize. I mean, that's all a testament to Alma taking something on paper and making it reality. And just the acreage itself, I think, is a testament to that commitment to preserve that land. So from 90 years, you know, mm-hmm. ago with that opening of just shy of 150 acres to today's acreage of more than 1,200. And I think that commitment to the land preservation played a huge factor in Keeneland's national landmark status, so, which came in 86.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And it is so quintessentially bluegrass, right? You come to Keeneland and it's still in some way, of course, it's, you know, beautiful and somewhat overwhelming and it's grandeur, but it still looks like a farm. That is not true at other racetracks as we've seen expansion. So can you talk a little bit about a little bit more about that desire to maintain that very Lexington feel?
Yes. I think that decision from all those possible sites, you know, back in 1935 that were being considered as, you know, possible next venues for racing in Lexington. I don't know. I mean, I think I've not been able to confirm this, you know, in the record that a bit of distance from town factored into that decision-making process. A lot of racetracks across the country, including the Kentucky Association track, did not have that potential advantage of growing acreage because they were in such a highly developed urban area that it was simply not an option. So, yeah, I think that's a whether it's I don't know the extent to which the intention was there, but it is it definitely was a part of that decision that's played out in Keeneland's favor in terms of being able to have that commitment.
Where was the Kentucky Association track located?
So the Kentucky Association track founded in 1826. They started hosting racing there in 1828. And it stood at its largest moment in history in terms of the acreage that it occupied, about 65 acres, north of Winchester Road between 5th and 7th Streets. So firmly in what is now Lexington's East End.
Very important to point that out because there's a long way from, you know, Versailles Road there. So
yeah. 6 miles almost outside of town.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that changes just how we, you went to the Versailles Pike, right? Like, so
right?
When Keeneland was first advertised, it wasn't, it's in Fayette County. It's not in the city. There's
right.
all of these differences.
Right. It was almost, you know, it was like a thing, right? Mm-hmm. It was an actual all-day outing. And as folks began to experience some relief after you started to leave the throes of the Depression, you do see there was always, to me, looking back, a remarkable amount of attendance and handle in those years. I mean, given what was happening economically. But as we move beyond that and towards the World Wars, you start to see those crowds increase even more. But then between 1943 and 1945, no racing was hosted at all at Keeneland. There were rations on rubber and oil in the state, and the commission and tracks decided that Churchill Downs, since it was on that public transportation route and Keeneland was not, would be the option for hosting racing. So Keeneland leased Churchill Downs for its meets between 1943 and 1945. So Keeneland Racing was held over in Louisville during the war, the Second World War.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Fascinating. And then it comes back and we get sort of,
oh my gosh,
what
yes.
is iconic Keeneland?
The spring meet of 1946 after the war, record-breaking attendance, beautiful photos from the track that day, the crowds that day, that first day back, and that whole meet. You can just feel in the photographs, you know, that just that promise of whatever it was that was coming next, and just relief that what had come before was before, yeah. You know?
That's, yes, just the euphoria of it and in those sorts of things. One other piece that I'm really interested in before we talk a little bit more about the library.
Yes.
You know, Keeneland, of course, for all of us is this, for many of us, right, is a social place. It's a place to sort of be seen and to see folks and to have good food and to maybe bet on a couple of races. But the real driver, its real economic impact is in the sales.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about the sales influence on the track and on the development? And
yes. So when Keeneland hosted its first tent sale, it was not Keeneland sales at all. It was Fasig Tipton that hosted a tent sale at Keeneland. And it was also because of World War II. So it would limit transport by rail up to where they would typically have that venue up in Saratoga Springs. A tent sale was hosted at Keeneland. But it didn't take long. By 1944, the Breeder Sales Company was formed at Keeneland. And it wasn't until the 60s that sales company and Keeneland Association merged as one entity. So, you know, for the first two decades, sales was its own thing. So when they hosted that first sale under the Breeders Sale Company umbrella, it shattered all, you know, North American records. And I think it was the average selling price was about $5,200.
Oh, wow.
Which is much lower than today's average, but much higher than I would think, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that a lot of folks would think. And the entire sale grossed $2.28 million.
I mean, that's a good day.
Yeah, it's a good day back in 1944.
Right.
Uh-huh. You know, so I think that speaks to how much the breeding side of the industry, you know, just the economic impacts of that. And today, you are correct in that, you know, that sales, you see those higher grossing numbers. But what I think is most telling about what how that translates to folks locally is that when Keeneland is hosting its auctions in a year and people are coming from all over the world to do that, they're spending between $330 and $340 million a year at local businesses and food and beverage and lodging and you know, so that is a big impact for our local community, and it comes in at about $200 million for the meats in a year too. So we do see more of those local economic impacts from the sale than the meats, but the meats are still coming in on average in recent years between about $180 million and $200 million in local spending at businesses that have nothing to do with racing. It's just where people are spending their money when they're in town.
Yeah, don't try to get a reservation anywhere in town in April or October.
Yeah.
Like, get them now because it's not happening if not. And it is, that is Keeneland driving all of that. So what you've mentioned this already, that within 3 years, the association says we need a library. Can you walk us through the expansion and the changes of the library and maybe tell us a little bit about what's going on now?
Yes, absolutely. So the ground did not break on our current building in 2000. So there were decades where the library was in its prior home. But I think what you see changing in that period of time is the types of collections. So there's it started as books, and then it evolved into photographic negatives and scrapbooks and more in the way of archival materials. Something that I am unbelievably proud of is that because our library has grown its collections primarily through donated acquisitions, we are in a position to freely share those with people. So given our service volume of about 10,000 researchers a year, last year from I think it was 27 countries. When I'm talking to my colleagues about our acquisitions budget, they're like, wait, what'd you say? it's always been the model that because people give to us, we can then give in return. So the collections have grown to the extent from that original 2,700 volumes and within the first 10 years to having some photo collections of glass plate negatives and scrapbooks. And you know, maybe our photos were coming in at maybe the 10,000 object mark to today's photo collections of 5 million plus, the 45,000 books, 25 million pages of newsprint. That was almost entirely donated. I mean, that's incredible. So our acquisitions budget is, we save it for new publications, for subscriptions, to information resources, or you can more readily and quickly connect those researchers who are primarily remote. So we're just kind of meeting people wherever they are with these research requests or these image requests, you know, to those resources. So I'm able to kind of maximize that budget for new additions to how people are chronicling the sport today. And what I think is, you know, when I started there at the library back in 2014, and as librarians, you know, there's this fine line ethically between people reaching out, seeking information, and us connecting them to that information. And that's it. You know, I mean, we're not there to make editorial decisions necessarily. You know, we're not there to have any control whatsoever of the product of what it is that's created with that information that we've given. Maybe it's a blog post. Maybe it's to satisfy somebody's curiosity. Maybe it's for a family history question. Maybe it's for a 5-part documentary series or an exhibit. you know, book articles. Those are the types of spaces we spend a lot of time in. We don't have any control over that. And, you know, we connect folks to it, but we're connecting that content to the content creators who then do whatever they will with it. But in recent years, because we have a good relationship with our recurring journalists and some of our recurring academics, once that relationship gets to a point where I feel like, maybe ethically I'm going to kind of get things a little murky here. Usually I wait till I'm asked, but sometimes I don't, you know, and it's just like, well, absolutely we can connect you to X, right? Like whatever it is that you're reaching out about. But have you thought about this? Or this story hasn't been told that often, or maybe not at all. Or maybe when it was told before, it wasn't told that well. And I don't mean that in a judgmental way. I just mean that we have more information now. So we have seen not only is the collection growing, but in the past 10 years, because of what we are connecting people to, it's shaping how people are writing and how people are posting, and stories that would not likely to, you know, wouldn't be as likely to have been told 15 or 20 years ago. Like with every year, we're seeing this huge uptick in books, articles, films centered on lesser told stories of the sport, especially the people. You know, so that's something that I'm really proud of as well.
Yeah, many of us have had the pleasure of seeing Heart of the Turf.
Yes.
Which is an example of this, if you want to talk a little bit about that. And then your new project.
Yeah, so Heart of the Turf, Racing's Black Pioneers. We have been traveling that. The History Museum hosted that traveling exhibit. It has since been in 7 states. And 225,000 people have now freely engaged with that exhibit. Learners of all ages, you know, across the eastern U.S. And for a 2-week period in France, where I was able to kind of bring that content there as well with our sister city in Deauville. So that has been incredibly gratifying, but it was only possible because of community partnerships, because of work that people locally and beyond Kentucky have been doing for years. You know, the collaboration with a historic consultant on that project, Yvonne Giles, the work of so many grassroots nonprofit organizations, universities. You know, so it's one piece, but we were very pleased and grateful to be able to play that one part. And we'll continue to travel it. You know, it's been updated once. We probably will update it again, bring even fresher stories into it within the next 2 years. But, you know, if folks are interested in hosting schools, public libraries, universities, museums, feel free to reach out. We travel that freely across Kentucky. And we have a new bilingual exhibit. It's the library's very first bilingual exhibit up now, and it is entitled Raíces, The Making of Latino Legacies in Racing. And on this exhibit, I was fortunate enough to work with an advisory panel of folks from 6 different countries. So these would be people who write about the sport every day, people who broadcast about the sport every day, photographers, people who work in the industry, historians. So having that many perspectives at the table really enriched the product. And then working with writers too. So yes, a lot of these folks on this advisory panel cover the sport every day, but they don't sit and stop and write biographical vignettes for an exhibit. So I had, you know, some of those were coming in Spanish and we had to take them to the English, and some were coming in English and we had to take them to the Spanish. And so if you come out to the library and visit Raíces, which you can do freely from Monday through Friday, 8:30 to 4:30, you will see a lot of that printed text in English, and you can listen to that exhibit's content in Spanish. And actually, because we had physical space limitations with the English, we didn't have physical space limitations with the audio guide in Spanish. So if you want to listen, you get more in Spanish than you do in English. And the exhibit also has a companion book. And that book is printed in English, and you can listen to it in Spanish now. But we are working on translating it into Spanish so that by the end of this calendar year, it will be in print in Spanish. And you can also, it will have that audio component in Spanish as well for accessibility. So, yeah, super excited about that. We've been hosting groups on exhibit experiences. And these exhibit experiences, for the most part, regardless of age of learners, there's a lot of engagement, maybe even forced competitive engagement. I'm like, it's no pressure, but yes, there really are prizes on the line. So it's just, you know, folks are walking around with clipboards and they are finding these, you know, these little nuggets buried throughout and what it is that they're seeking, what it is that we're asking them to seek. Those are very, very intentional pieces that where we're trying to drive home and reinforce the core themes of this exhibit, which is showcasing the work and lives of men and women from across the Americas at every level of the sport over time. So that time element, that deep historical context, and men and women from every level of the sport. So you'll see folks who work on the backside in every role. You'll see folks out on the farms, CFOs, CEOs, lawyers, photographers, journalists, broadcasters, handlers, vets, accountants. You know, we worked really, really hard to show that depth and the breadth of the contributions and just how nuanced and complex that workforce is. You know, so we do this engaged, what I call forced engagement, together and then, or separately, and people can buddy up if they want to, but, and then we come together and then we convene and then kind of talking through that is just an amazing opportunity to see everything kind of click and connect, and for people to ask some pretty amazing questions. So,
and that'll be on display through the year.
My goal is through Breeders' Cup. Right. Which, if that's what happens, then that would be the longest we've ever had an exhibit at Keeneland Library.
And for our listeners who maybe aren't as tuned in, yes. When is Breeders' Cup?
All right. We're going to be right after the October meet, right coming in right in at Halloween this year in 2026. And that I think, is a kind of a fitting part of the celebrations of the 90th, too, you know.
I guess we should, I would bet that a lot of our listeners know that Breeders' Cup was founded by Lexingtonians in Lexington, but can you give them why it matters that it's at Keeneland?
Yes. So this will be the fourth time that Keeneland has hosted. They hosted for the first time in 2015. And then again in 2020.
We know what happened
right?
then.
Right. 2020. And then in 2022 with the excitement of Flightline. And of course, 2015 was amazing with American Pharoah making history with, you know, on the heels of the Triple Crown, then, you know, comes in with this win for that Grand Slam with Victor Espinosa in the saddle. So fourth time hosting, and yes, you know, Breeders' Cup, you know, its offices are located in the old courthouse downtown, and I can't speak for the entire racing community or for our community in general, but I do know that what I hear a lot in my role as a librarian is that it kind of feels like coming home, you know, so there's that sense of, I think, those more traditional kind of pieces or kind of this staying presence. And like you said, and this beautiful, almost overwhelming with all this acreage, you know, this context. And it's certainly a unique experience. Although it won't be unique for the roughly 100,000 people that come in. I mean, there'll be a lot of people experiencing it, you know, but yeah. Yeah, every year's a little different too because you got different excitement about the players, and so yeah, we'll see how this fourth iteration at Keeneland, it's looking to shape up to be something pretty special
with new buildings that fit into the historical architecture, and all of that is driven by, you know, I was at a recent conversation with some of your colleagues who were reiterating the importance of making sure that when you come to Keeneland, you see this new paddock building, but you don't feel like it is new.
Right.
I thought that was incredible, that the continued focus on the preserving the history of the site as well as the history of the sport and those sorts of things that are happening. So if we're coming out to the meet in April, we can come see the exhibit.
Yes.
What else is going on in the library?
You can meet some of the folks featured in the exhibit and people who worked with me on the exhibit at a race day signing for that exhibit companion book on Saturday, April 11th from 11 to 3 on the North Terrace. The library partnered with the National Museum of Racing, and we published... It's literally 10 pounds. Well, no, I'm sorry. That was a little bit hyperbolic. It's a 9.5-pound book entitled Racetracks of America. And there's really been no chronicle like it before. So it was last year's publication, but on the 18th of April from 12 to 4, just outside the Keeneland shop, we'll be hosting a race day signing of that book. Again, that was a joint publication between us and our colleagues up in Saratoga Springs. And you can book exhibit experiences. Reach out to the library directly to do that. After our meet, we'll be hosting Tom Leach on April 29th in a Derby handicapping event at the library. And we've got some really amazing inspirational stories coming up in our summer lineup for our lecture series as well. And don't forget about our story times, free events that always, honestly, I'm not supposed to go on record saying things like this, but probably my favorite thing that I do. Those are always a joy too. So just reach out, follow us on our website. And there's a lot in the way of in-community programs and field trips and things that might not be abundantly clear on the website. And that's okay. Just call us and we'll make it happen. Okay.
And you can find all that information at Keeneland.com.
Yeah, Keeneland.com/library.
Perfect. Thank you for getting us ready for the races and for all the excitement that's going to come in throughout this 90th year of racing at Keeneland and in Lexington.
Thank you so much again for having me.
It's laid out all right in front of us. I mean, you can almost see it from here.
I mean, I need Burgoo real bad after this conversation. I'm going to have to go down to the track kitchen and get myself a cup.
Yeah, yes, absolutely. And Rhoda, yes, thank you so much for coming in and giving us all that history on Keeneland. And I mean, it's a place steeped in history. And who better than you to tell us all about it? I mean, it's just great.
Well, thank you so much.
Yeah. Mandy, what do we got coming up in April?
So we have a couple of exciting things in April. Spring break, Fayette County Spring Break Week is also Navy Week in Lexington.
How did they make that work?
I got this call. I was like, Navy Week? Okay, tell me more.
It's one of my favorite colors.
Yeah, I wish. You know what? Wouldn't that be great? Yeah. So the American Navy, the United States Navy, is coming to celebrate the Navy in 250 years of the United States starting April 7th. They'll be throughout the community. I think they'll be at Keeneland for the races. And on April 9th, the Navy History and Heritage Command, whose entire job are to be naval historians, like who knew that was a thing? They will be at the museum from 12 to 4. Engaging with folks. If you need something to do on spring break, if you're looking for a way to see some connections between the Navy and Lexington, please come out to the museum. I assured them that there was water here. They laughed at me because it's not big water.
Town Branch.
Right?
I mean, maybe.
But there was water here. So we're really excited to have them. And you'll see them throughout the community that week. I know they're setting up the Children's Museum and they'll be out at the races and there are some other spaces. And then on April 29th, if you don't need a betting handicap from Tom Leach, you can join the museum at the Willow for our inaugural event at the Willow, doing a little bit of racing, derby history over some drinks and some cocktails. Ooh. With the Willow. So that'll be a free lecture, price of purchase for your alcohol. You can hear from me and from Aaron Goins of Bites of the Bluegrass about a little bit of we're gonna try and be pretty fun about this, so you're not gonna get stodgy Dr. Higgins. It's gonna be, you know,
gonna
like,
keep it light,
silly Mandy Higgins with some fun stories about Anita Madden and the Derby and Lexington. So if you know how to bet, you can come with us. If you need to need some insight on your Derby bets, please go see Rhoda and Tom Leach at the Keeneland Library.
All right, one more time. When can people go to the library?
So we are open Monday through Friday, 8:30 to 4:30. But if you are interested in an evening experience or a weekend experience, like say behind the scenes library tour or an exhibit experience, you can't make it there during the work week, do reach out to me directly. And you can find my contact information again at keeneland.com/library. We will always find a time to welcome you.
All right, and Mandy, when can we go to the History Museum?
Yeah, you can visit us Thursdays and Fridays, 12 to 4, and Saturdays, 10 to 4 at 210 North Broadway. Like Rhoda, we will make it work for you. So please reach out to us via our contact information is at lexhistory.org. And we would love to see you.
Yes, and we'd love for you to download this podcast and tell all your friends, because we'll be back next month with another edition of Lex Talk History.
You've been listening to Lex Talk History, a monthly podcast produced in collaboration with WUKY and the Lexington History Museum. Subscribe to our show wherever you get your podcasts, or download Lex Talk History from the podcast page at WUKY.org. And if you haven't done so already, please make plans to visit the Lexington History Museum soon. Get started on your tour at LexHistory.org.